I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, two stories about Americans taking the economic crisis into their own hands. Later in the half hour, we'll go to Chicago, where laid-off workers have taken over a factory. But first, to Miami and the housing crisis. Speaking on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, President-elect Barack Obama said he's disappointed that President Bush hasn't done more to stop foreclosures, and Obama promised to take action shortly after he's sworn in. But a Miami, Florida housing activist isn't waiting. Florida has one of the highest foreclosure rates and also thousands of homeless people. Miami-Dade County received federal money for affordable housing, but a Miami Herald investigation found it was squandered. The homes never built. Enter Max Rameau, the activist, who's now acting like a real estate agent, matching these homeless people with people-less foreclosed homes. That's right. And it's completely illegal. Max is with the group Take Back the Land. He joins us from Miami. And we understand, Max, you've placed six families in homes. You have nine on a waiting list. This is all out in the open. How is that? This is not your property.
Well, we think, actually, that we have a greater right to the property than the banks who own the foreclosures or the governments who are keeping these properties empty. I mean, the banks are getting billions and billions of our dollars. They don't own our dollars, and yet they're getting them. And those are billions of dollars which are not then available to provide help to human beings. And I think if we have to choose between giving help to human beings and giving help to banks, I would always choose the human beings.
Well, I want to talk more about that. But some would say, well, wait a second. We live in America where, you know, people who own things own them and the banks own the homes after they're foreclosed. So how do you even find the homes?
Well, there are lists available all over the place of foreclosed homes, and so you can find them on the Internet. You can purchase lists. You can get them mailed to you. More importantly, if you drive through your own neighborhood, as we've done, you can see a bunch of vacant, empty houses that are not doing anyone any good anywhere, including the banks. And so we don't think that it's good to have, where literally we saw in some instances an empty house on one side of the street, and on the other side of the street, an individual or a family basically living in a park or living in bushes.
Well, and so how do you hook them up? First of all, how do you pick which foreclosed homes you're going to take?
Well, we only do government-owned or foreclosed homes. We don't do those that are owned by individuals. And then when we identify those, we go to the home. We, you know, check it out several times. We go inside and see what the condition is. Obviously, we don't get funding for what we do, so we have to be able to fix it up in decent condition with a minimal amount of money. We can do some drywall. We can do some painting, some sweeping and vacuuming, and some, you know, some minor repair work.
So you're not making. I mean, you're not hiding. You're moving in a crew. You're fixing up these homes.
Sure, and we move. We change the locks, and the family gets a key to the lock, and we want them to come in and out of the front door. We don't want them sneaking out the back, and they bring in their furniture, and they move in their family. They get the lights turned on in their name, the water, and everything like that.
And how do you find the families?
Well, the families have been coming to us. Obviously, we don't do any kind of advertising, but families do find out about what we're doing. We're pretty well known in the neighborhood, so people who are in this situation come to us.
Well, now, so you've set up, as we said, six families. You've got nine on a waiting list, and they are living in these homes. We understand it doesn't always run smoothly. Didn't one of your families that you move in come home to find their things had been moved out?
Yes. Well, just about every family has been found at some point. We had one family who stayed for 7 months before they were found. And one family which we recently moved in, they came home and the locks were changed and all of her things were stolen out of there. So when an eviction happens, the company has the right to evict things and put them out on the sidewalk, but they're not allowed to steal valuables. And this is what they did. They stole a computer, they stole her television, they stole baby clothes, and they also took, you know, some personal valuables, family albums, her transcripts. She has a master's degree and is working on a PhD. They took all of her transcripts.
Well, now, Max, I got to hold you up there for a second because, you know, you say the things were stolen. We've talked to people whose livelihood it is to go in, and it pains them, but their job is to go in and clean out foreclosed homes. And we understand from them that, you know, when they approach a foreclosed home, what's ever left, they might not even have known it was from your new tenant. Whatever is there, they have to get rid of. I mean, they have to throw out. They have to get rid of.
They don't have to keep. They have to throw out. They have to throw away. They're not allowed to go in there and make a sandwich, or they're not allowed to go in there and drink the soda. They're not allowed to go in there and take televisions. They're allowed to go in there and put the things on the curb. It's not their property. Even if they're allowed to put it out on the outside, they're not allowed to keep it for themselves. This is not a shopping trip. It's a eviction. They stole the valuables. There were plenty of things that were in the trash, but there were plenty of things that were stolen.
I hear what you're saying, that they took what was valuable. But, you know, people would say that's the risk that your homeless tenant took. And, you know, someone would say that she stole the house.
Well, there is a legal principle. I'm not a lawyer, but there's a legal principle that says the commission of one crime does not justify the commission of another crime. So if someone steals something out of a store, you're not then allowed to shoot that person and take what they stole and think somehow it's yours. Mm-hmm. So even if you think that it is a crime, which we don't necessarily agree with, but that doesn't give the bank then the right to steal her stuff.
Well, and in fact, that woman moved back in afterwards. What do city officials say to you? What have the police said to you? You know, as you said, you're being very open about this.
Well, we have been open about it. When we did the first move-in in October of 2007, we announced it publicly. It was a big story in the local media. And the police haven't said anything to us. The elected officials haven't said anything. And the staff of the elected officials joke about it sometimes or ask if any of these move-ins are going on in their district, but they haven't said anything beyond that. I think what's happening is that people are recognizing that this is a real crisis that's impacting millions and millions of people. And particularly in Miami-Dade County, where there's been such a history of corruption, stealing money that's supposed to go to low-income housing, it's going to seem very, very cruel for the government to come in, spend additional resources to move out a homeless family in order to create a vacant house on behalf of a bank.
Well, the Associated Press reports that a city spokeswoman, when asked by them, said that the city officials didn't even know you were doing this. And then she went on to say, if people trespass on private property, it's up to the property owner to take action. So they seem to be distancing themselves, maybe, as you say, recognizing, you know, at least somebody's going in those houses. And I'm wondering, what do the neighbors say?
Well, before we move anyone into any of the locations, we go and we talk to each of the neighbors on either side and across the street from the homes. And in every instance, we let at least one neighbor know exactly what's going on. But most of the time, we let all the neighbors know. And so the neighbors have welcomed them in. The neighbors feel safer with there being a family in there. A lot of times, these houses, when they remain vacant, they attract people who just want to come in for a night and you know, have the safe harbor of a home in order to do things, you know, which they couldn't do out in the open.
Right.
And we've had, in fact, many strong friendships and relationships develop because of these move-ins. In one house we had, the pipes were disconnected from the kitchen, so they had running water everywhere in the house except in the kitchen, so they'd do the dishes in the bathroom. But the neighbors then would bring over water for this family who was in this house, and they developed a friendship and a relationship, and they were glad, and they thanked us for introducing them.
Well, and it keeps their property values up, I would think.
It keeps their property values. In addition, the house that the family is staying in keeps a lot better because no one is coming in there taking out wiring, taking out plumbing, and doing whatever other kinds of damage. So the families are actually doing the bank a favor.
Well, you feel that you're doing the bank a favor.
I think the bank should be compensating them for saving them thousands of dollars in damages.
Well, you know, Max, someone say, why not try to work within the system in a way that's perfectly legal? We read that in Cleveland, advocates are working with the city to allow homeless people to legally move in and repair empty homes. In Atlanta, there's a system where some property owners pay homeless people, you know, to live in abandoned homes as a security measure, just what you've been talking about. So why not go to the city?
We've done those here. We've arranged for that to happen here. So we're not against that happening at all. We encourage that to happen. The problem is it's not happening on any kind of scale that makes sense given what the level of the crisis is. And so I think it's immoral for there to be vacant homes which are owned and controlled by these banks that are getting billions of dollars of tax money while there are people living out on the street. So it's one thing to say, let's have this happen legally, if it is happening legally and if people are getting housing. But people are not getting housing. Less and less people today have housing than they did a year ago. So to say, well, let's do this in the system, that only seems to be working for the banks who are getting this big bailout. It's not working for regular people. And my concern is not the banks. My concern are the people and these families who don't have any place to stay.
Well, and you're a longtime activist. People might remember you and others built a shanty town on the site of a low-income apartment complex that had been razed. It was called Umoja Village. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
Plywood, cardboard, closet doors. It eventually burned down, though, in a fire. And, you know, I'm just wondering, here you are moving families in. They don't have insurance. You don't know that much about them except that they're desperate for a home. I mean, do you worry about the liability?
Well, we certainly worry about the moral liability. But what we have found is that the families are much safer inside of these homes than they are out on the street. And so we had one family who moved in who a few nights before we moved them in, had been, as a family, assaulted because they were sleeping in an empty lot, and someone came by and assaulted them, and nothing to happen to them during the 7 or 8 months that they were inside of that one home that they were in. So we think that they're much safer inside of a house. And there are people who purchase their own house, who rent their house, who also, there are fires that happen. Fires don't only happen in places that are abandoned or squatted. Fires happen all over the place. And so I think it's a little disingenuous to say that, you know, well, what if fires happen over here, as if it's something that only happens in this situation. Fires happen everywhere, and that's why there's a fire department, that's why there are safety standards. We try the best that we can to make sure that families have a safe place. The place that they're staying is not, may not be as safe as many other places, but it is much safer than being on the street.
I guess that, you know, their safety is increased, but I'm just thinking that in this case, it's a home that they don't own, and I'm just, you know, the liability, would they be accused by the bank, held responsible, you know, as opposed to if a shanty burns down?
Sure. Well, we're very concerned about that also, and we think that problem will be solved by elevating housing to a human right and making sure that every human being had housing by virtue of the fact that they are humans, rather than making sure that every bank had a bailout by virtue of the fact that they're billionaires giving money to elected officials.
Max Rameau, a housing activist in Miami-Dade County, part of the group Take Back the Land, placing homeless people in people-less homes, as they say, abandoned foreclosed homes. Max, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
And by the way, we called the city of Miami for additional comments. They didn't get back to us. And this last note, that homeless family that had their things taken from the foreclosed home that they'd taken over, Max is hoping to negotiate with the rental agents who are selling the house to let the family stay until it's sold. Not sure how that's going to go. A RE/MAX spokesperson told the Miami New Times, yes, I'd like all homeless people to have a place to stay, but you can't take other people's property. Well, tell that to laid-off workers in Chicago who've been occupying a factory since Friday. And today, Governor Rod Blagojevich ordered the state of Illinois to stop doing business with the factory's creditor, Bank of America, not just a major lender to the Republic Windows and Doors factory, but also a recipient of the government bailout. Now, here's the governor today.
If the taxpayers who do all the work in our country have been already asked to bail out these big banks, then we expect those banks to bail out businesses like this to keep them afloat and keep these workers working.
Monica Davey is covering the story for the New York Times. And Monica, we're up against a break, so we'll just take a minute here and then come back with you. But what is the connection here? What is Bank of America saying about its obligation to these laid-off workers?
Well, Bank of America, first of all, says that they really can't talk about an individual company that they lend to. But they also say that the company itself is responsible for living up to the promises it's given to workers, not the bank.
And yet, are the workers saying that when companies have to pay back creditors like Bank of America, it's always the workers' pay and severance and vacation that goes first?
That's exactly what these workers are saying.
And what is the company saying?
The company is not saying much at all. In fact, they have been entirely silent throughout the weekend, even as workers sit inside the factory plant and have slept there all weekend.
And just give us a little bit of sense. As you said, we're up on a break. We're going to take that for a minute. But what's it like there at the factory?
It's actually remarkably calm. When you hear the word occupation, you sort of expect it to be... You sort of expect it to be a hectic, chaotic situation, but it's really quite peaceful.
Okay, we want to hear more about that from Monica Davey of the New York Times, about that occupied factory in Chicago. We'll have more after a quick break. Later, advice for President-elect Barack Obama on navigating the Middle East, but also his thoughts on workers taking over their factory. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We just started speaking with Monica Davey of the New York Times in Chicago, covering the worker occupation of the Republic Windows and Doors factory. 250 workers were laid off with just 3 days' notice last Friday. We've been speaking also about the governor's surprise announcement that the state of Illinois is going to suspend business with the Bank of America, which holds the credit line for the factory. Monica, you were telling us the mood there. I want to hear more, but first a little bit about, you know, what happened. Here's union representative Leah Fried speaking this morning on the early show about how this all came about.
They were told on Tuesday last week that they would be out of a job on Friday, penniless on the street, no vacation pay, no severance pay owed to them under the WARN Act. So people have been very strong, very united, and they're not going anywhere until they win justice.
Monica, tell us more about this. What are these workers standing to lose?
Actually, they're standing to lose vacation pay that they say is already owed to them. Of course, they've already lost their jobs, but they also say that they were not given the 60 days of notice required under the WARN Act, which is what Leah was referring to there. The only complicating factor is that the WARN Act also has some exceptions to it. In every case, a company is not required to give that 60 days, and that may be something that's argued over between lawyers as we go along here.
And tell us more about the Warren Act.
Well, the Warren Act, which was passed during the Reagan administration, is something that, again, requires a company that's a large company like this to give its employees 60 days of notice, or at least 60 days of severance pay if they're going to close suddenly. But there are several exceptions, one being something called the faltering company exemption, and one being an exception called the unforeseen business circumstance. So as you can imagine, those are the sorts of exceptions that if the company were speaking about this, I imagine they might be raising.
Well, but the workers are saying that they had not a sense of a problem until they were told they were out of a job.
That's right. Shortly before Thanksgiving, some of the workers noticed machinery disappearing over one evening. When they got back to work, a little bit of machinery was gone, and they asked the management about this, and the management said all was well. So they say they had no sense. Many workers said they were absolutely stunned during a staff meeting that was held last Tuesday afternoon when they were told that the place was closing down. Entirely.
Shuddering, yeah, shuddering. Well, and yet, some might say these are people who make windows and doors, and we know how the construction industry has been really pummeled in the last couple of months. You know, do they believe that their company is failing?
It's interesting. When you talk to these workers, they have a variety of theories about what's happening. Some of them actually believe that the company is doing just fine, that they've been making plenty of windows and doors and sending them out to various sites. And they believe that the owners somehow want to reopen somewhere less expensive and get far less expensive workers. That's one theory.
So part of, we understand, part of the occupation that's going on now in this factory is to keep the factory from being moved, is to keep the factory from being shuttered. Tell us more about what they're doing there. They've been there since Friday night, these workers. What's happening there?
Right. It's actually kind of an interesting scene. The workers themselves are on the plant floor, which looks sort of, as you'd imagine, lots of windows and doors in a giant room. But nobody else, they are themselves preventing other people from walking onto the factory floor. So I, for example, wasn't allowed to go mm-hmm. onto the factory floor. They are sitting in chairs, just sitting there. Some of them are cleaning things. They've been getting so many donations, offerings of food and help that they're sort of trying to keep those tidy and straight. They say they're shoveling the snow, which has come down a lot here, and otherwise trying to keep this, they say, as peaceful as they possibly can.
Monica, what do you make of this? Because this, we think this may be the first sort of, you know, uprising in the wake of the government bailout of banks. And again, if you just joined us, one of the things the workers are saying is that the Bank of America, which holds the credit line for the company, could have allowed the company to pay the workers their salary, their severance, their vacation, the things that they felt they deserved ahead of other debt. So they're saying the Bank of America could have used some of the federal bailout money, taxpayer money, to pay off the workers' debts first as opposed to other creditors. What are you reading into this that, you know, they've taken over a factory?
It is interesting to see. It is, I think, a first sign of the level of frustration that some of these workers are feeling. And the bailout really, I think, has pushed it over the edge. They feel like that was their tax money helping the banks, and now when they just need to get their salary, the banks are nowhere to be found. That's their position on it, and they say that they're making history, so they do see the size of the decision to do something like this. And they also say that they hope other workers will follow them. And so it'll be interesting to see what comes.
Well, other workers might, because the governor isn't the only official to support the workers. This weekend we heard from President-elect Obama on this issue. Let's listen.
I think that these workers, if they have earned these benefits and their pay, then these companies need to follow through on those commitments.
That seems unusual to us that the president-elect would almost, you know, he's absolutely taking the side of the workers who have taken over a factory.
I think that's right. I think you have to keep in mind that the president-elect is here in Chicago, and so he's very aware of sort of a local situation that's been going on. But it is interesting, and actually you've seen over the weekend, we here have watched officials, lots of officials coming through lots of political leaders stopping by to offer their support. Representative Gutierrez, Jan Schakowsky, another U.S. rep, and of course, Reverend Jesse Jackson came by yesterday, and more were expected this afternoon.
Yeah. Well, he's also the first president-elect, in my memory, that was also a community activist at one time. But we're wondering if it sends a signal that the government is going to make many more strings attached to bailout money, including pay the workers first. That's Monica Davey covering the Chicago factory occupation for The New York Times there in Chicago. Monica, thanks as always, and we'll touch base again with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that story. Also tomorrow on Here and Now, former CIA agent Robert Barr argues that the last thing India should do in the wake of the Mumbai attacks is confront Pakistan. We'll hear from him on that. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, another foreign policy challenge, the Middle East. What should President-elect Barack Obama do there? A peace activist says maybe nothing, at least now. After the news, Here and Now. Here's some advice to President-elect Barack Obama from a veteran diplomat and a longtime advocate for Middle East peace. Essentially, forget about Middle East peace. Aaron David Miller goes on to say, it's not possible right now. Miller has worked with six secretaries of state over the past 20 years. He left the State Department in 2003 to serve as president of the international youth organization Seeds of Peace. And he's now a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. His fourth book, The Much-Too-Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, comes out in paperback this month. And he joins us from a studio at the Wilson Center. Welcome back, Aaron.
It's a pleasure to be here, Robin.
And you've been reminding me, sadly, that one of the very first deaths in the Second Intifada, the Palestinian uprising in 2000, was one of your Seeds of Peace kids.
It was Asil Asla, who was actually an Israeli Arab, a Palestinian citizen of Israel, was shot to death by Israeli security forces in October. No one, I think, embodied the ideals and virtues of Seeds better than Asil. It was a real tragedy.
And when we talked here on Here and Now with some of the Israeli kids that he'd met through your program, which brings Palestinians, Arab Israelis, Israelis to camps in the U.S., he bawled like a baby. And I was just thinking about that today. And, you know, it feels like a million years ago. There is still violence. We see it even recently. But, you know, that kind of Intifada-like violence has been tamped down. Why do you think that it's so hopeless, you know, the idea of Middle East peace?
Well, my argument is not that there can't be Middle East peace. I just believe that right now, if you looked at the two negotiations that still remain to be done, there's almost no chance of an Israeli-Palestinian conflict-ending agreement in which the four core issues that drive their conflict, Jerusalem borders, refugees, and security, can be conclusively resolved. I do believe, however, that there is a very real possibility that an Israeli-Syrian agreement, a peace treaty, can be negotiated within several years, assuming that the President of the United States commits himself to this, and you have Israeli and Syrian leaders who are prepared to pay the price. So I'm not denying the possibilities. I just think that we have to be cruel and unforgiving in the way we assess what is possible and what isn't, because Americans, with their pragmatism and optimism and at times naivete, can believe in something too much and not see the world the way it is, but see the world the way they want it to be. And that can be a very dangerous preoccupation.
Well, let's talk about what you think are some of the roadblocks to peace now. And some of them are obvious. You have the Palestinian split between Fatah and Hamas, and then both Hamas and Fatah also divided.
I think the issue of a divided and dysfunctional Palestinian house is a critically important issue. No Palestinian right now can claim to speak for all Palestinians, and no Israeli prime minister would make the kinds of concessions that would be required to a Palestinian leader who doesn't control all the guns. So unless you have one gun, one authority, and one negotiating position, it seems to me almost impossible not just to get a Palestinian consensus, but to attract a serious and interested Israeli partner. So that's a huge obstacle.
You write that there's serious dysfunction at the political level in Israel as well. Israeli President Ehud Olmert, who's stepping down in February after corruption charges, has become increasingly candid. He says Israel's going to have to withdraw from almost all of the West Bank and parts of East Jerusalem. to make peace. You know, is this too little, too late? Does it not matter if, as you said, there's not the leadership on the other side? Is it just going to have to remain sort of on the back burner for a while?
Well, you need leaders who have both the incentive and the power. One without the other is not sufficient. Ehud Olmert is a good man, a pragmatic man, a man who clearly, I think, over time has developed the incentive, but he lacks the capacity. It may also be that the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, has the incentive, but lacks the power, the capability. I'm not hopeless. I remain moved by a phrase articulated by the first and last president who really influenced me, and that was Jack Kennedy. Kennedy described himself as an idealist without illusion. And that's where I think America needs to be, never giving up on the possibility that Arab-Israeli peace can be brought to fruition. But as we go about our peacemaking, go about it with your eyes wide open.
Well, and you say start maybe by stepping to the side a little bit. And you've advised President-elect Barack Obama to, as you just said, start with negotiating peace between Israel and Syria, maybe negotiating the dispute over the Golan Heights, which Israel now controls, and then, you know, deal with some of those issues and come back at the Palestinian question. But is there something that you would recommend Barack Obama do in the meantime?
Yeah, I think you, Robin, you've identified a critical point. We can't just push on Syria and do nothing on the Israeli-Palestinian front. That won't work. So my advice would be to continue to train Palestinian Authority security services, continue to pour economic assistance, not just into the West Bank, but into Gaza. All I'm suggesting is do not go for a high-level, high-wire, Camp David-like agreement, because you will not succeed.
The Brookings Institution and the Council on Foreign Relations have just released a report that says Middle East peacemaking should be a major priority for Obama. But they seem to say also go at it indirectly. They say Obama should launch a comprehensive diplomatic initiative involving direct and unconditional talks with Iran. Now, of course, Barack Obama as a candidate got in trouble for advocating talking to Iran without conditions. Your thoughts on that advice?
Look, my view is that Iran sits at the nexus of just about everything America cares about in this region. Iraq, Lebanon, the Arab-Israeli peace process, nuclear proliferation. Our policy with respect to Iran is broken. It's not working. I don't know whether or not serious and sustained talking to the Iranians will work. It may prove to be a key to an empty room. But the fact is, our other approaches, the prospects of military action or somehow acquiescing in Israeli military action, economic sanctions have not worked. Talking to Iran under almost any circumstance makes more sense than not talking.
Well, and one of the people that might be doing the talking is the new nominee for Secretary of State, presumed to be passed by the Senate on this, Hillary Clinton. Now, you wrote, when there was speculation about the Secretary of State, that it has to be someone who is an actor, a teacher, a tactician, an intimidator, someone who, when they walk in the room, people sit up and take notice. Is she the right pick?
I don't want to prejudge her. She's an able, talented, and she's about to become the 67th Secretary of State of the United States of America, and I wish her nothing but the best.
Well, and you're right, it takes America's friends and adversaries about 5 minutes to figure out who really speaks for the White House and who doesn't.
Well, the notion that somehow what Obama's trying to create or should be trying to create is a team of rivals doesn't make any sense. She needs to be the White House's woman at the State Department, not the State Department's woman at the White House. She needs to reflect his views. She needs to argue with him. She needs to stand up and speak truth to power when she doesn't agree with something. But at the other end of the process, what must emerge is a seamlessly implemented policy. Because if she separates herself from him, it'll take less than 5 minutes for our friends and adversaries to begin to play us like a finely tuned violin.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Aaron David Miller, what kind of relationship do you think the U.S. should pursue with Israel going forward? I mean, you've talked about perhaps trying to negotiate peace between Israel and Syria as a start, but just Israel to the U.S., you've said it should be a special relationship, but not the exclusive relationship that it's been for 16 years. What do you mean?
What I mean is that America has a rock-solid commitment to the security and well-being of the state of Israel. That special relationship is driven by shared values and by common interests and at times common adversaries. But what has happened under 8 years of Bill Clinton and 8 years under George W. Bush, that special relationship which serves American interests has, in my judgment, become an exclusive one where several things happen. We coordinate everything with the Israelis in advance. We are unable to adopt our own positions. And we have a tendency to agree with Israeli ideas, some of which don't make any sense for American interests. I'm calling for a recalibration. Yes, we can be Israel's best friend, and I would argue we must be, but we can also be an effective and fair mediator in this conflict. I mean, the fact is, if you want an agreement and you're a broker, your client becomes the agreement, and you effectively become an advocate for each side. We cannot become simply an advocate for one.
Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator, now a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. His fourth book, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, comes out in paperback this month. Aaron, thanks so much as always.
Robin, it was a pleasure.
Well, let's get some of your thoughts in. Last week, we spoke with an egg farmer in California about the new law passed by voters in November, which requires that farm animals have more space. Chicken farmer Ryan Armstrong says he simply can't afford to buy more land to build bigger cages. But he also feels cageless farming isn't healthier for chickens, and many of you agreed. Nathan Cordes of Niles, Illinois writes, "Animal lovers no doubt meant well trying to legislate more freedom for chickens. The problem is that most of the voters have not raised chickens. The farmer was right. Chickens are cruel. They regularly gang up on the weakest among them and peck it to death, or just constantly peck at each other to maintain their status in the flock. The concept of pecking order came from chickens. This silly law that the voters passed will also drive up the cost of eggs." Well, Judy Crawford of Wilmington, Massachusetts, did the math. She writes, "For breakfast, my 16-year-old will eat 2 scrambled eggs, toast, juice, tea, and occasionally a small bowl of cereal. If he doesn't eat scrambled eggs, he would eat cereal. Cereal costs $3.99 a box. A dozen ordinary eggs costs $1.49 and has more nutrients. A law that drives an egg farmer out of business and unemploys his workers can't be good. What were they thinking?" Well, many of you wrote after conservative pundit P.J. O'Rourke was on the show, criticizing conservatives for losing the election but taking a few swipes at the poor and single moms along the way. I asked P.J. if he thought divisiveness was a conservative failing. He said no, to which Clifford Fuel from Colorado responded.
"Regarding P.J. O'Rourke, okay, I'm biased. I've been a fan since Rolling Stone article days back in the 70s. However, the man's a breath of fresh air. I admire people who get to the chase."
But Charles Devine of Dover, Massachusetts, had the majority listener opinion. He writes, "The hardcore of the GOP share the warped belief that they have a monopoly on morals. They forget that their party is the refuge of religious, racial, and sexual intolerance. It might be too late to save the patient, however, as the cancer may be incurable." Finally, a response to our Thanksgiving program. We spoke with Carl Chapin, who lost a hand in Vietnam, recently gave a kidney to a stranger, and is uncomfortable with being called a hero. John Banderob writes, "I'll try not to aggravate Mr. Chapin by calling him a hero, but to me, he represents the kind of courage that's required to look squarely at the life you have and the life others have and do the right thing." And Gib Monikoski, delighted to discover us on WNIB in DeKalb, Illinois, wrote about our Thanksgiving chestnut, the visit with my late Uncle Locke in Vermont. Gib writes, "I also had an uncle who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He, too, would downplay his involvement as your uncle did." Gib also asked about the music we played. It is Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. We'll be back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. And we want to take a return trip now to the 16th and 17th centuries, when European countries were pushing beyond their boundaries, sailing the world in search of the thing that fueled their economies, changed cultures and palates. Spice. Back then, cinnamon, nutmeg, pepper had a significance beyond flavoring.
That ground-up tree bark in your morning oatmeal once had the scent of heaven. The grated tropical nut kernel topping your eggnog set in motion a world trading network. And those shriveled little berries in your pepper grinder gave the cue for Europe's entry onto the world stage and its eventual conquest of the world. The origins of globalization can be traced directly to the spice trade.
The spice wars of the 1500s and 1600s have been compared to the fight over oil in modern times and had an often bloody history. For example, nutmeg was at the root of the exploitation and murder of thousands by the Dutch in Indonesia. Well, food writer and historian Michael Crondall writes about how the spice trade shaped the fortunes of Venice, Lisbon, and Amsterdam in his book, The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice. It's now out in paperback. We spoke to Michael when the book first came out and asked, why spice? How did it help these cities become trading empires?
The reason that I'm convinced that spices were really the stuff of empires so early on was just because they kept. If you take pepper, you can transport half the world away. If you take, let's say, mangoes, try transporting them all the way from India to Europe in a ship that takes about 6 months.
You do object, though, to the comparison of spices and the early spice wars and how spices, you know, led to empires. You reject the comparison to oil today. Why is that?
If you look at oil today, of course, it, you know, literally makes all the wheels turn. But in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, spices were inessential. They were just something that a few rich people put on their food. They were like an iPod. They were like bottle of extra virgin olive oil. And in this, I think it's very interesting because when you look at a food that has virtually no nutritional value, all you're left with is culture and economics and things like that. And so in this way, spices are a great way to study European food culture and the way that that in the end affected the whole world.
Well, let's get a timeline. The spice trade went from Venice, which first controlled it and became medieval Europe's most cosmopolitan center. Then Portugal sailed around the Cape of Good Hope to unseat Venice. Then in the 1600s, the Dutch take over. But you went to Venice where, you know, as you write, merchants from Alexandria and London once traded pepper and cloves. And you tried to find a whiff of that spice trade, but you couldn't. People didn't have a sense of it.
Venice used to be a great trading empire. It was sort of the Singapore of its day. And then they lost their markets. There was no pepper trade to be had because they'd been pushed out of it by first the Portuguese and then ultimately by the Dutch. So I think people don't like to remember bad events.
Well, and one of them included way back in 932 when Venetians had competitors in a town 50 miles down the coast called, was it Camaccio?
Camaccio.
They simply rowed their galleys there, burned the citadel, massacred the inhabitants, carried off the survivors, and made them swear an oath of loyalty in Venice.
Well, people didn't run businesses in a terribly ethical way in those days. And, you know, when you fast forward to what the Portuguese did and what the Dutch did later on, they'd learned a great deal from the Venetians. And they really just ran protection rackets. If you stop to think about what the Dutch did when they moved to Indonesia, they would arrive at an island and they would point their guns at the island and they would say to the local inhabitants, look, we'll protect you from the English and we'll protect you from the Portuguese. And all you have to do is just give us your nutmeg at the prices we set and then you'll be safe. I mean, the mafia did not invent this stuff.
You also profile Lisbon. The expansion of into the spice trade there was because of the monarchs who wanted to expand their reach.
Well, you have to realize that the Portuguese monarchs are living in this tiny little kingdom. They're living beside these much greater monarchs, and they really have no way of paying for their lifestyle. So they didn't have much choice but to go somewhere else. So they started in Africa, and they just kept going until they got all the way to India, at which point they were able to finance virtually half the kingdom from the receipts of the pepper trade.
And by the way, why did Venice lose its pepper trade?
Primarily because the Dutch were so efficient at kind of throttling the spice trade and monopolizing it in the Far East that there were just no spices getting to Venice for them to trade.
You say the Dutch had a very modern motivation. They just wanted to make as much money as they could.
The Dutch had a very modern motivation. The Dutch organized what was, but to all intents and purposes, the first modern corporation.
Now I want to ask you about how spices themselves were used. You write about medieval banquets where spices like cinnamon, ginger, and nutmeg were used throughout the meal. Describe some of those banquets and how spices were such a symbol at the table.
Well, I think when you look at a medieval table, you have to realize that it isn't there merely to feed people. It's there to impress. And the spices were typically added at the very, very end of cooking, which had probably a couple of reasons. One is that they were relatively expensive. So if you were going to use a small amount, you got the most bang for your buck. Secondly, they would have an aroma. I think we forget that spices have this intense aroma and that that may well have been the reason that they were sprinkled on at the very end, so that as these dishes were brought into these large halls, the perfume, the scent would precede them. And in a sense, you'd be living in this kind of perfumed banquet where smell, taste, and kind of the impression of being, you know, near the extremely important king or whoever would really overwhelm all of your senses, not just your sense of taste.
Let's go through some of the, maybe they are myths. Did they use spices to disguise rotting meat?
Spices were not used to disguise rotting meat because the people who could afford meat could afford to throw it out.
Did they use it as mouthwash?
They probably would have used it for mouthwash. Remember that dental hygiene wasn't so good in those days, so anything you could wash out your mouth to make it taste better would have been a good thing.
What else did they use spices for that we might, you know, not think of now?
Medicine. I think the very important thing about the Middle Ages is that food was considered medicine. And there was a system, the so-called Galenic system of medicine, where you had four humors. You had hot, cold, wet, and dry. And each food would somehow fit into this system. But spices were considered to be extremely highly concentrated. So that, for example, if you were eating fish, which is wet and cold, and eating wet and cold things was supposed to be kind of bad because it would lead to bad diseases and all that sort of thing. But it was a Catholic world in those days. They eat fish at least twice a day. So they would sprinkle lots of hot spices on these fish so that the fish would no longer be cold. They'd now be balanced with this heat that came from the spices.
Tell us a little bit about the more recent history of spices.
Well, spices lost their cachet at the end of the 17th century, and the reasons for this are probably many, but one certainly is that when the Dutch got a monopoly on cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves, they doubled the price. Europe, in the meantime, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and there are fewer and fewer of these richer people, but they're richer and richer. And they're no longer interested in spices. Spices are so yesterday. So now spices are no longer popular. The middle class can't afford them. And gradually, Europeans at least, now this doesn't happen in the Arab world, it doesn't happen in India, it doesn't particularly happen in China, but in Europe, they start using less and less. And then the 20th century comes along, and particularly the post-war era, where now globalization, there's another enormous burst of globalization. People are going from one part of the world to another part of the world, and now spice use is going up and up and up.
Author Michael Crandall, his book, The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice, is now out in paperback. Fascinating. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.